Sorry, the Texas case.
Mr. Douglas and Mr. Longhouse, open the arm of the petitioner.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Douglas, representing Wally Scott trustee. This case has a simple but far-reaching issue. Under the Relict Act, is Exxon entitled to any additional compensation as partial owner of the soil for an assignment of the McAllen State Bank to Wally Scott trustee, made more than 58 years after the original leasing transaction? I will cover the factual background, the lack of statutory authority to award Exxon any additional compensation, and the Relinquishment Act case law and the doctrine of strict construction, which defeats Exxon in this case. Mr. Rangel will cover the public policy arguments, the stipulation agreement, and the Attorney General's letter in another lawsuit. Exxon seeks an unconstitutional gift of the state's mineral interests and property in this case. The Court of Appeals, for the first time in Texas jurisprudence, has ruled that the owner of the soil, Exxon, as agent for the state, can merely because of its position as a surface owner, simultaneously become the owner of a working interest in a Relinquishment Act lease 58 years after the original act of leasing. This court has staunchly and adamantly protected the state's exclusive ownership of its minerals in Relinquishment Act lands for over 60 years, beginning with the first Relinquishment Act case, Green versus Robeson. The only basis upon which Exxon is entitled to a participation in the mobile lawsuit settlement is by specific statutory authority, in other words, a legislative grant. Exxon will not cite you a statutory authority for that, and if you read the Court of Appeals opinion, you will find that they do not cite a statutory authority for that. Neither can cite a statute, because there is none that authorizes the owner of the soil to receive a part of an assignment of Relinquishment Act leases in settlement of a lawsuit. A brief factual background will show that in 1925, the Duval County Ranch Company leased approximately 64,600 acres, which consisted of about 14,300 acres of minerally classified land, and they executed the lease as the agent for the state, as owner of the soil, and approximately 50,300 acres that were privately owned lands. Exxon owns 30.39% of the surface now, and Duval County Ranch Company and Clinton Mangus owns the other 69.603% of the surface. Exxon and Mangus and their predecessors have received one half of the royalties for over 55 years and continue today to receive receive royalties from Wally Scott trustee and receive them monthly. On July the 7th, 1982, Clinton Mangus sued Mobil with reference to the 1925 lease. The cause of action alleged to be 1, lease termination, 2, failure to reasonably develop, 3, fraud, 4, damages. Mr. Mangus developed the facts in this hotly contested lawsuit. He brought the facts to the state's attention, and Mr. Mangus pursued with vigor the litigation. On December the 31st, 1982, the state intervened to protect its interest. After approximately a year of extensive and detailed negotiations, an agreement was reached for settlement, and trial was set. Just on the eve of trial, on December 19, 1983, Exxon intervened. Exxon then filed its notice of lese pendens also, and Exxon pleaded in their lawsuit that by virtue of their status as a surface owner, they were entitled to a share of the settlement proceeds. After further negotiation, Exxon dismissed its cross-claim of Mobil. It severed its counterclaim against Mangus, the state of Texas, and others. This separate counterclaim is our case that's on appeal today. The original Mangus versus Mobil litigation went to trial on January the 5th, 1984. The Mobil lease was declared valid. That's the 1925 lease. Mobil on the same day assigned the entire lease to the McAllen State Bank, reserving a 1/64th royalty in the non-minerally classified lands, in other words, the approximately 50,300 acres. The McAllen State Bank on the same day assigned the minerally classified lands to Wally Scott Trustee. That was the 14,300 acres for the GLO for the benefit of the permanent school fund. And the McAllen Bank signed the balance of the acreage, the privately owned acreage, to Morris Atlas as trustee for the benefit of miners. The land commissioner asked Wally Scott to serve as trustee because of the pending sale of the leases involved. Mr. Scott was to hold legal title, to arrange for the sale, and to operate and maintain the lease until the sale was consummated. Because of the cloud placed on the state's title by the Exxon lawsuit, the contemplated sale was not consummated. All parties in this severed litigation then filed motions for summary judgment. Exxon filed one, State of Texas filed one, and Wally Scott trustee. The trial court granted both the state's motion and Wally Scott's trustees and denied Exxon's. Appeal was taken by Exxon to the San Antonio Court of Appeals. And under the authority of this court to equalize dockets, this case was ordered transferred to the Texarkana Court. The Court of Appeals ruling will give the surface owners, in this case Exxon and Mangus, one half of what the state received in settlement for the mobile lease lawsuit. There is no statutory authority for such a ruling. Section 52.171 of the Natural Resources Code, incidentally Section 52 is now in effect the Relinquishment Act, 52.71 appoints the owner of the soil as the agent of the state. 52.172 authorizes the owner of the soil to sell or lease the oil and gas under the Relinquishment Act lands or the minerally classified lands. These leases are fully assignable. Section 52.182 provides that the payment of 10 cents per acre and 1/16th of the production to the owner of the soil shall be in lieu of all damages to the soil. The Relinquishment Act minerals are owned by the state. The surface owner is only authorized to lease. He does not own any interest in the minerals. There is no statute authorizing any land owner to automatically receive any part of any assignment of an oil and gas lease on the state's ownership from a lawsuit. There is no additional compensation contemplated for the surface owner after it leases. That's set at the time the lease is made. And if production is obtained, then that surface owner is entitled to one half of the royalties in the future. That event has occurred here and has been occurring for approximately 55 years. The owner of the soil is compensated for leasing the Relinquishment Act lands in lieu of all damages to the soil. These statutes do not provide for any additional compensation. Understandably, the Court of Appeals does not base its decision on statutory authority. This Supreme Court has held that the grant of state property under the Relinquishment Act should be strictly construed in the state's favor. What's not expressly granted is reserved to the state, and that has been this court's consistent position for almost 60 years. In 1932, in Empire Gas and Fuel, the court said that strict construction applies to these lands, and the grant said. In 1967, in State versus Standard, this court said it again. And in 1986, in Schwartz versus State, the court perhaps most eloquently stated it then when they said, the rule is also well settled that legislative grants of property, rights, or privileges must be construed strictly in the favor of the state on grounds of public policy. And whatever is not unequivocally granted in clear and explicit terms is withheld. Any ambiguity or obscurity in the terms of the statute must operate in the favor of the state. The Court of Appeals lifted language out of context out of two Supreme Court decisions as the basis for its decision. It said the language, quote, other sums, end of quote, and the language, quote, other amounts, end of quote, from Cross versus Shell and from Green versus Robeson are the basis for awarding Exxon one half of the settlement that the state achieved in the Mobil lawsuit. Upon a reading of those cases and the language that has those terms in it, it is clear that what the Supreme Court was referring to at that time was the actual act of original leasing. And in fact, in Green versus Robeson, it says if a bonus is paid, if a larger royalty or other amount are contracted for, the state and the owner of the soil receive equally in like amount. And that contracted for can only occur in the original leasing. The cases have held that the surface owner is not entitled to amend the state's lease. Let me also point out that the settlement actually benefited Exxon. If the state had been successful in terminating the lease in the Mobil lawsuit from 1932 forward, which was the date of the motion for summary judgment, effective date of the motion for summary judgment that was filed in that case, then Exxon and the other royalty owners would have been required to refund to the state all of that production because that was unauthorized production. The impracticability or unreasonableness of the results from Exxon's status theory is illustrated by one, if they become a co-working interest owner with the state, who pays the bills? Who drills the wells? Who operates the leases? Secondly, suppose Mobil, in this case, had decided in order to settle it that they would not make an assignment of their lease, but instead would release acreage in an adjoining 5,000-acre tract in which Exxon owned no interest. The owner of that 5,000-acre tract, or release that tract, makes a new lease on that and gets a bonus of $500,000. That surface owner must pay one half of that bonus to the state of Texas. Under Exxon's theory, then Exxon would be entitled to 30% of one half of that bonus that the state received from the adjoining tract because it received that bonus as a result of the settlement in the Mobil lawsuit. Or suppose that the royalty had been divided from the surface in this Mobil lease. After the lease is made, then the surface owner can convey or retain the royalty under that particular lease during the term of that lease. Suppose that had happened here, and you had a royalty owner and a surface owner. Under Exxon's theory, who does the state pay its proportionate part to? The current surface owner who owns none of the royalty, or to the royalty owner who gets one half of the royalty now under the current lease? The state needs flexibility in settling its litigation that involved minerals under the Robeson Act. This court has held that the state has the exclusive right to sue with reference to those leases. And we submit that the state has exclusive right to settle Relinquishment Act lawsuits without having to give up its mineral rights or any of its proceeds, and that the Court of Appeals decision will discourage these settlements, and it should be overturned. Thank you.
Counsel, how much money are we talking about in all of this?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about, Your Honor, as far as currently. Mm-hmm. Under the operation of Mr. Scott, I'm personally aware that the profits have been in excess of $2 million to the state of Texas. And as I understand Exxon's claim, they would claim 30% of half of that of course, the lease is continuing production, and they would, as I understand their position, would claim all future production under that lease.
Who is going to argue or handle the stipulation and escrow agreement?
I would like to turn that over to Mr. Rangel, if I could, if Your Honor, but I'll be happy to respond in rebuttal.
No, I just know it's a point in the brief, and I just wonder who would like to discuss it.
May it please the Court. My name is Jose Manuel Rangel, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Texas in this matter. I've been before the court on a couple of occasions prior to this one, and there's no doubt that in each of those occasions it's been extremely pleasurable. But what makes this case stand out is the fact that I don't only have the law in support of my case here, But I've got the state's constitution, the equities, and common sense bursting at the seams in support of the state's position in this case. Any way you look at the case, the state should win. There are two good reasons that I'd like to point out to the court as to why we should win and why the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed. First of all, Exxon did not perform its required responsibilities under the Relinquishment Act. And secondly, following in the line of what Mr. Douglas stated during his portion of the argument, this court has required, since the Empire Fuel and Gas decision, a strict construction of the act. And whatever is not specifically given up to the surface owner is retained by the state. For each of those reasons, either one of them or both of them, the state should win. I'll address each of those issues separately. I'll start with the responsibility issue first. The state strongly believes that a permanent school fund agent has a continuing responsibility to protect the best interests of the permanent school fund. There are strong public policy reasons for that belief. Since 1919, it's estimated that approximately $1.6 billion have been paid to the surface owners as agent for the state of Texas in permanent school fund leases. In just the last 4 years, $250 million have been paid to surface owners. If we're going to so richly compensate our agents out of constitutionally protected revenues, revenues that have been earmarked for the permanent school fund, we should be able to expect the highest duty on their part, the highest responsibility on the part of the surface owners. It is the Land Commissioner's duty to oversee the oil and gas operations conducted on nearly 3 million acres in the state of Texas. To carry out these duties properly, he must be able to count on the services and the responsibilities of the surface owners. He can't do this all by himself. In just the last 4 years, the commissioner has been given approximately $14 million by the legislature to carry out that duty and that responsibility. But as I stated earlier, during that same four-year period, surface owners have been given $250 million. A surface owner receives 50% of the bonus and delay rentals and continues to receive royalties during the life of the lease. It is simply inconceivable that an agent who is rewarded on a continuing basis would not owe a corresponding duty to the permanent school fund to look after its best interests.
What did Exxon do wrong?
In this case, Your Honor, Exxon was given notice on May 26, 1982 by the chief clerk of the General Land Office that the state of Texas had problems with this lease. In that letter to Exxon, it specifically listed the state's claims. It enclosed documents, records supporting those claims. And then it asked Exxon, Chief Clerk Jack Giberson, asked Exxon to look at its own records and its own documents and to come up with its own opinion and get back with the General Land Office. The General Land Office never heard from Exxon. And indeed, it wasn't until this case was about settled that Exxon even decided that it wanted to take part in it. And not to protect the best interests of the permanent school fund, but to protect its own interests, or at least what it believes are its own interests, and to come in and basically claim it's 30% of one half of the settlement, solely referring to its status as a surface interest owner. And that's all. It didn't assist the state in any way. It didn't bring any of the facts to the state's attention. And I would like to point out another thing in the line of what I've been stating, Chief Justice Hill, and that is that Commissioner Morrow and Attorney General Maddox strongly believe that there's an ongoing duty on the part of the surface owner to look after the best interest of the permanent school fund. Now take Exxon, for example. The most sophisticated, the largest oil and gas company in the world. If there's anyone that would be able to uncover facts similar to the ones that Mr. Mangus brought to the attention of the state, it'd be Exxon. They have the records, they have the expertise. And during this 50-year period, the state was claiming in the mobile lawsuit that early on, the lease terminated because a well had not been drilled during the 90-day drilling provision. So that's another way in which Exxon has not carried out its duties and responsibilities, and that is to check up on how the lease is operating, to see how the operator is carrying on his responsibilities, whether they're drilling wells, whether they're paying royalties, whether they're reasonably developing the mineral estate. Exxon did none of that. But what really stands out the most here is the fact that Exxon did not lift a finger. It was informed. It was told. And it can talk about all the secret conspiracies that it wants to talk about. And obviously it fooled the Court of Civil Appeals into believing that, the Texarkana County Court of Appeals, because there's no other basis upon which Exxon claims that it should be entitled to this except for its status as a surface owner. Now, we went out there, the General Land Office went out there and told Exxon, this is what we're going to do. Will you tell us what you think?
Well, it wasn't until the case was settled. Excuse me, just a minute. Exxon, when this, were they completely out except for the fact that they were surface owner, and what they're asking now is part of the settlement that was made, so as their interest as a surface owner, rather than because of what their responsibility was as an operator or a producer out there?
That's correct. They're only basing it on, or solely basing it on, their position as a surface owner. And the Relinquishment Act does not give it that compensation.
And so whether they did produce well or didn't produce well, dug a well or didn't dig a well, doesn't make any difference. They're claiming their interest as surface owner, are they not?
That's exactly right. But they do point out in their brief that there was some secret conspiracy. Obviously, they want this court to believe that somehow they've been mistreated. And I want this court to understand that they have not been. It is perfectly clear that Exxon had no interest in protecting the best interest of the permanent school fund. That's obvious. They didn't do anything until the time that the case was settled. And then even then, if anything, instead of assisting, they caused more trouble than anything else. And there's the issue is simply this. Can spending such tremendous sums of money to compensate an agent on a continuing basis be justified when the services performed are at the most minimal? And Exxon services here weren't even minimal. There were no services at all. If they are going to be entitled to anything, and as Mr. Douglas pointed out, there's nothing in the statute that says that they should be entitled to any portion of the settlement, but if they are going to be, it seems like good public policy would require that Exxon, our surface owner, provide us the assistance that we need. Now, what good public policy is served by rewarding an uncooperative, recalcitrant surface owner like Exxon? Clearly none. What can be expected from less sophisticated surface owners when the largest, most sophisticated oil company in the world doesn't come forth to help us out? Now, from the state's perspective, it would very much like to have this course announce what the state believes has always been one of the surface owner's responsibilities to the Permanent School Fund, and that is that surface owners have an ongoing duty to protect the best interests of the Permanent School Fund. Now, such a decision would surely have long-standing policy effects and would clarify once and for all the proper role of the surface owner. This case could very well be, and in my opinion should be, the most important decision to come out relating to the Relinquishment Act and the responsibilities and duties that the surface owner owns to the Permanent School Fund since the Green v. Robeson decision and the Empire Fuel decision. We have got to be told what the duties of the surface interest owner are.
Is it your position that Exxon's already been paid all they're entitled to as the royalties paid?
Exactly right. Now, they point out that this settlement is some type of a new leasing agreement. Well, it's not a new leasing agreement. It was a lawsuit where the state was claiming that their minerals had been wrongfully converted, that there was a trespass on the mineral estate belonging solely to the state. And that's one thing that we need to make clear here, that the state owns the minerals. Surface owner does not own one bit of the minerals, and the only reason he receives any compensation at all is because of the existence of the Relinquishment Act.
Cronell, since your line is on, I don't know what weight the Court of Appeals gave the stipulation. They just referred to it, and then they walked on down the road. What is your legal response to the stipulation the state of Texas entered into in which they agreed that Exxon was entitled to some additional compensation?
I'm glad you asked that question, Chief Justice Hill. That stipulation, in my mind, all along, has been a non-issue. The Court of Appeals cited it. It shouldn't have cited it. To begin with, Exxon, and obviously the Court of Appeals, have taken this stipulation, this paragraph number one and paragraph number four, completely out of context. The state and Exxon know that that's not what the commissioner meant. But that's irrelevant. If they wanted to have a binding statement by the state of Texas in this lawsuit, and clearly, as I point out in my application for writ of error, it's ambiguous as to what the commissioner says. But if it were to support Exxon's position here, and that is that Exxon should be entitled to a proportionate share of the settlement, they should have come to the Attorney General, Jim Maddox, and asked him to sign that stipulation. And in speaking with Attorney General Jim Maddox in preparation for this argument, he told me he would never have signed this stipulation. There was no reason for it. And it was obviously something, as was pointed out in the amicus curiae brief filed by the Honorable Ralph Yarbrough and Commissioner Morrow, that there were reasons, separate reasons, for having filed that stipulation. And I think that they most eloquently state within their amicus brief why that stipulation was signed. But we've got to get back to the main question, and that is, should that have even been considered? And our position is no, it should not have been. And secondly, even if it is considered, it doesn't make any sense. The only thing it could possibly mean is that Exxon, that the commissioner recognized that Exxon was entitled to some portion of the settlement, and clearly it is. It's allowed to continue receiving its portion of the royalty. But Commissioner Morrow was stating within his stipulation that whatever else or whatever he may be entitled to is something to be decided by the court. He wasn't giving anything up at all. It's clearly ambiguous.
Are you going to make it in the statutes regarding the right of a state official to stipulate anything for the state?
Well, it's well settled, Chief Justice Hill, that, and I think I've cited a couple of cases in support of that position, either in my application for of error or in my reply, that once a lawsuit is filed, that only the Attorney General can bind the state. And because Attorney General Jim Maddox, who was the Attorney General at the time, did not sign the stipulation, it should have never been considered. Does that answer your question?
But your answer, I'm not sure it's what the statute. Are you suggesting the Attorney General can bind the state by stipulation?
If we had actually stipulated to something that made any sense, it wasn't ambiguous as this stipulation is, obviously if it had said Exxon is entitled to its proportionate share of the working interest which was assigned to Wally Scott trustee, that'd be a different story. But that's not what it says. And obviously, to begin with, the Attorney General didn't sign that stipulation. It's a non-issue, Judge, and it really bothers me that Exxon, and I think it shows how desperate Exxon is, to keep referring to the stipulation. It doesn't mean anything, and it shouldn't mean anything. And this court should reject it and not even take it into consideration in deciding this case. Now, I was also to respond to or discuss their claims or arguments that there had been a previous Attorney General letter that was sent to Commissioner Morrow involving a separate lawsuit. I believe it was referred to in my application for of error as the Exxon lawsuit. That's another non-issue, and that once again shows that Exxon does not have a case. It can't cite the statutory authority, as Mr. Douglas pointed out, to support its position, because there is no statutory authority to support its position. That AG letter involved a totally separate case. And in that case, the state was arguing that it never got its complete bonus. That's the Exxon lawsuit. And it was claiming that it should have gotten its bonus. Well, that's another matter I was discussing with Attorney General Jim Maddox. And obviously, we all know how involved Attorney General Jim Maddox has been with the Relinquishment Act, being that he was personally
Counsel,
involved in
the
mobile
lawsuit. Record?
Pardon?
Your conversation with Attorney General Maddox in the record?
No, it is
not. Please complain.
That's fine. But, and I apologize for that, Justice Rosales, but getting back to that Attorney General letter, it involves issues that are not before the court. It involves totally different facts, claims, and a totally different settlement. In that Exxon lawsuit, if you look at what was ultimately done in that case, a new lease was executed, that $4 million bonus was paid, a higher royalty was granted for production beneath 10,000 feet, lower than 10,000 feet, and acreage was released. That was a separate leasing transaction, and in this case, we don't have that. In this case, we have a lease termination lawsuit where the state of Texas is claiming that Mobil wrongfully produced its minerals for 50-odd years, and that it's well settled in the law. The Colquitt decision states that, and a number of the decisions that this court has issued, that the owner of the mineral estate alone has the authority to bring a lawsuit to recover damages for the wrongful production of its minerals. And as I pointed out earlier, the state alone owns minerals. Here in the surface owner owns no interest whatsoever in the mineral estate. Thank you.
Hear from the respondent.
Mr. Adams, is that argument for respondent?
Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Shannon Ratliff. I'm with the Austin firm McGinnis, Lockridge, and Kilgore here today representing Exxon Corporation. And with me is Diana Borden of our firm who has worked with me in connection with this matter. I think that the court is well aware of the facts, and Mr. Douglas did a good job, I think, of going over the basic fact pattern. I see no reason to repeat it. I might, I believe, at this time, most profitably respond to a couple of questions that were asked in the course of the petitioner's argument. The first issue that I believe, or at least one of the issues raised, was one raised by the Chief Justice with regard to whether the stipulation, if signed by the Attorney General, would have been binding on the state. And while I'm sure they probably codified it, Mr. Chief Justice, and I don't remember what the codification is, the old Article 4411 probably would have prevented anything from the Attorney General if it was viewed as a waiver of known right of the state of Texas. At least there would have been substantial doubt about its validity. If you will note in our briefs, however, both Court of Appeals and in this court, we've indicated that the question of whether that is a binding stipulation is beside the point. The fact of the matter is, a state official charged with the duties and responsibilities of carrying out the laws with regard to the public domain, the state of Texas, stated in that document and in a document that he knew was going to be filed in court, made the statement that he felt that Exxon was entitled to some portion of that settlement. He simply wanted a court to tell him what amount. Now, the fact of the matter is the court can take that for what it's worth. It was offered as summary judgment proof. It was not stricken by the trial judge. It was not stricken by any court at this point. But the fact of the matter is, Commissioner of the General Land Office made that statement. We do not have to rely on that. And as a matter of fact, we've been challenged by both the attorneys for the petitioners to cite any authority for the proposition that we advance today on behalf of Exxon. They say you cannot find a statute to point to that will say that you're entitled to a portion of these settlement proceeds. And as this court well knows, you cannot find in the statute, as it deals with the Relinquishment Act, a great deal of the law that relates to the Relinquishment Act because, as a matter of fact, this court in Green versus Robinson had to substantially rewrite the statute in order to maintain its constitutionality. The statute very clearly on its face purported to give to the surface owner 15/16 of the mineral estate. To avoid a clear constitutional problem, the Supreme Court said, well, that really wasn't what was intended. What was really intended was to make them an agent. And for carrying out that agency and for the damage to the surface, you're going to be entitled, the surface owner will be entitled to one half, assuming that he owns the full surface, one half of what he has received for the lease. And if the court will go back and read those early cases, and this goes to the question of strict construction and to the case which Mr. Douglas read from, if you go back and read the early cases, it is clear that the court said that applied to bonus, even though the statute says nothing about bonus. And the rule of strict construction that has been relied upon by the petitioners in this case was cited in the Empire Fuel case, which struck down the legislature's attempt to come back and tell this court we meant it when we said the landowner gets 15/16. But in the Empire Gas and Fuel case, the court acknowledged the strict construction rule, said we recognize that grants from the legislature are to be strictly construed and are to be construed in favor of the state. We acknowledge that bonus is not mentioned in the statute, but under Green versus Robinson, that is what is required, and the landowner is entitled to that landowner's proportionate share of the bonus. Now, I would submit to the court that, as a matter of fact, if there are people weak on authority, it may be the state of Texas, and it may be Wally Scott trustee. But let's look at the question again of why is Exxon Corporation here saying that they are entitled to a portion of the proceeds of this settlement. That was not an idea that was new or originated with the Exxon Corporation. Attached as exhibits in our brief, and they were also exhibits in the motion for summary judgment, is a letter from the Commissioner of the General Land Office to the Attorney General of the State of Texas dealing with the question of what should be done to divide settlement money paid at least in partial consideration of the validation, renewal, and extension of a Relinquishment Act lease. And in that letter, the Land Commissioner says, the judgment requires that I, as Land Commissioner, satisfy the requirements of the Relinquishment Act. Under the case law of Green versus Robinson and Cross versus Shell, my staff has advised me that my legal responsibilities are as follows. In view of the fact that this is a disputed lease, and that we are adopting, confirming, and ratifying this lease, requirements of the Relinquishment Act guarantee that the states share equally with the surface owner or owners all consideration received. Now, in this argument before this court, as they did before the Court of Appeals, the state seeks to avoid this interpretation by saying it's a different lawsuit, but secondly by saying outside the record, Exxon was a bad agent, Clinton Mangus in the case you're talking about in that letter was a good agent. If you will read the letter that's attached in the part of the record, you will note that the letter clearly infers that Exxon Corporation, the defendant in the case, would have been entitled to share in those settlement proceeds because of its status as a Relinquishment Act owner, except for the fact that the state had required a waiver from Exxon in connection with that settlement. Attorney General Maddox writes back to Commissioner Morrow in that same matter and says, you have concluded that the Relinquishment Act requires you to share equally with the surface owner or owners all consideration received. Based on the judgment and a study of the case law, I agree that the surface owner should receive a portion of the $4 million. It then goes on to quote Cross versus Shell Oil Company, in which it states the Relinquishment Act authorizes the owner of the soil as agent of the state to sell or lease the oil or gas from the land, whereupon the state and the owner shall each be entitled to one half of all the royalties, bonuses, rentals, or other sums received under the sale or lease. And the Attorney General goes on to hold that the Land Commissioner's interpretation is correct, that the surface owner, as a surface owner, is entitled to share in the proceeds. Now, insofar as the attempt is now made to say that those are the rules for a, quote, good agent, I'd like to point out what I believe to be a glaring inconsistency in the state's position and in the position of Wally Scott trustee. And that is, they say that they have repeatedly said in this argument that I must show statutory authority, that everything goes back to the statute. I would invite the court's attention to the statute to see wherein the duties of the agent are outlined in any regard. A recent amendment, long after this lawsuit was originated and long after the trial court judgment, a recent amendment attempts to scale out or to sketch out some of those duties. But it was not in effect at the time that the judgment was entered in this case.
Well, haven't we had a common law principle that's since Shetler versus Smith about duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Your Honor, I'll trust you on where it arose. I will tell you there has been a common law duty for a long time. I don't dispute that, and I'm not attempting to dispute it. But I am saying that they're here arguing that I've got to find something in black and white in the statute. And what then they go into this gloss on the statute of what makes good and bad agents. And I'm not certain that there's any more support even in the fiduciary duty law, because you've got an anomaly in the Relinquishment Act that I think, and I think Mr. Ron Hell said something in his argument where he said, well, the landowner, the surface owner has a duty during the continuation of that lease to protect the state's interest. And yet, as I read, I believe it's Cocklett versus Gulf Oil Corporation, the surface owner is given absolutely no power to proceed to protect those rights, at least in the normal terms. I think you're obviously well aware of the fact that in many instances the agent, in order to protect the subject matter of the agency, can go in and bring the suit to protect it. In this instance, it has been clear since early on the surface owner has no such right. And in fact, in Cockwood, it was held that the surface owner could not institute the action nor maintain it, that was solely a matter for the state of Texas. Now, in terms of the policy, I hope I answered your question, Mr. Justice. In terms of the policy, I think it also needs to be pointed out here that what Exxon is saying is that if the state of Texas, exercising its sole right to control the litigation and to control the settlement, elects to settle in the manner in which they settled here, that the Relinquishment Act and the cases that have interpreted require that the surface owner share equally in that settlement.
Why?
Because, and there's a, excuse
why?
Me, go ahead.
Why? No, I said, okay. Why? Since you've already been
all
paid,
right.
As the royalties were being paid out.
Yes, sir.
Earlier.
But the reason is this, Mr. Justice Ray, if that case went to conclusion and that lease were terminated, there would be a new lease executed, and at that point, the state would get half of the bonus, delay rentals, and royalties stipulated under that lease, as would the surface owner. So when you say we've already been paid, I agree, we've already been paid under that lease. But as was pointed out in the commissioner's letter, in the other matter, it is clear that he views the validation of that lease as being tantamount to the entry of a new lease. And what we say is, at that point, the surface owner's rights should attach to that settlement. Now, in this instance, the matters referred to in that letter, of course, were cash settlement. In this instance, there was no cash. It was for the working interest less. No, in the mineral classified, it was for the working interest in the lease. But we've got, go ahead, sir.
I thought his position was that Mobil got minerals that it was not entitled to. And since the state owns all the minerals, the state alone should be paid for those that Mobil took that it was not entitled to.
Well, I guess I've heard it characterized a lot of different ways, and I'm not sure which one it is. I don't believe that there was anything in any of the summary judgment proof that said that was so. I think that the summary judgment proof simply is, this is the deal we made. But I think the point you raise is, well, but we're being paid for past production which Mobil shouldn't have been entitled to. But the fact of the matter is, by the act of ratification of this lease, they in fact validated that production by Mobil. And therefore, I guess if you treat it as validated production, again, the state's interest would be that of a royalty owner. And in a royalty owner's position where we would be entitled to our proportionate part of one half of that royalty. Now, I recognize that there's a tough spot in here because this happens to be one case that I don't see how anybody can say, you need to lead me right to the statute and point to the language, because the statute really doesn't relate to a lot of these problems we're talking about. But it seems to me, once they validated that lease.
No, how did they validate it?
They validated it because, Your Honor, while they talk about a trial occurring, it was a settlement.
and then Mobil came in and put on evidence, and a judgment was entered. The state and the other parties in the lawsuit simply stood moot and did not put on any contrary evidence. But it was a settlement with a judgment validating lease. And it's done all the time. I understand that. And we're not complaining about that procedure. We're simply saying that we're entitled to our proportionate part. If you'll recall, if that lease had been invalidated, at that point, the leasing power would come back to Exxon and the other service companies. You'd have the sole authority at that point to execute a lease.
But that settlement agreement didn't declare the lease, I thought it declared the Mobil lease invalid, reverted to the state of Texas, or Mobil assigned it to the McAllen State Bank.
Yes, sir.
And then assigned it to Ollie Scott Trustee as agent for the state of Texas.
They broke it out at that point, Your Honor. They broke it up into the private lands, which went to
Mangus,
and they broke it up into the public, into the now classified lands, which went to Mr. Scott.
So at that point, after it had been, this part that's in controversy here, it had gone to Mr. Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Then, instead of executing a new lease to a new operator, he operated it for the state of Texas. The question is whether Exxon gets a half of that one half that came back to the state, or about 15% of the total lease.
About 30-something percent of a half, that's correct.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I misunderstood what you said. The lease was never, there was never an agreement that the lease was invalid.
But it was an agreement that it would be assigned.
There was an agreement that it would be assigned after a judgment was entered validating the lease. And at that point, Exxon's right to share as a service owner in the proceeds of any releasing were cut off. We had no opportunity to negotiate with the lessee to see whether we could get a higher royalty, which the state would have gotten half of.
Well, are the mineral classified lands are being operated by Wally Scott Trustee, I think under contract with an operator. With an operating company. Did
Mr.
I respond?
Mr. says you lay back in the weeds and you let the other people do the work. You weren't interested in the lawsuit. You weren't pushing it at all. And then when you saw that there might be something to be gotten, if you came in at the last minute and tried to get part of it, what do you say to that?
Well, what I say to it, Your Honor, is that I don't have any right prosecute that lawsuit, nor to control it, nor to control the way the lawsuit is developed. Colquitt says that is the state's prerogative. It is the state's prerogative to the exclusion of the surface owner, and that the surface owner has no standing to assert the invalidity of a mineral classified lease. And the fact of the matter is that they can throw those kind of rocks all they want to, but the fact of the matter is, if you look at the letters, and if you look at their earlier rulings, they don't say anything about you either coming in and presenting us the evidence or not presenting the evidence, or whether you play dog in a manger or otherwise. Our position here before this court is very simple. And that is that if the sharing of the settlement proceeds arising out of the earlier DCRC case, if the sharing of the settlement proceeds with the service owner in that case was correct, Exxon is entitled to recover in this case on the same basis, and we believe that there is substantial authority under the Relinquishment Act for that position. But it's not a real convoluted argument, nor are there a great deal of authorities for you to wade through in terms of that position.
Now, are you contending that in effect there's been a releasing through that settlement?
Yes, sir. Exactly. And I think that is...
What are the facts that would justify that?
Well, what you have, Your Honor, when I say a releasing, yes, sir, tantamount to a release. The fact of the matter is in this case, as in the earlier DCRC case, they came in, they said, this is an invalid lease. It has been invalid, if not from inception, from the second or third year of its term. We're entitled to recover back all that you, Mobil, have received out of it. Case goes on for a period of time. There was also, I think, a contention that it had been invalidly joint, that the one lease covered both mineral classified and private lands. So it finally comes up to the point they settled. When they settled, it is our view, it wasn't a settlement where they said, okay, pay us X money or convey us some extra property, and you keep on running the lease as lessee, Mobil. That wasn't what happened at all. Mobil fully assigned their rights on the mineral classified lease to Wally Scott trustee to hold for the benefit of the state of Texas.
But as surface owner, are you not still receiving royalty under that original mobile lease?
No doubt about it. That is correct.
You are.
And we make no contention that we're being deprived of what was, what we had under the lease. What we're saying is that the state has exercised its right to solely control and settle in a manner that is tantamount to annuities.
Following up on Judge Campbell's question, how has Exxon been hurt? Exxon leased the land, I suppose, if you buy it after you entered into the lease with Mobil. Exxon
actually, Your Honor, we were a successor in interest to who entered into the lease.
You stand in shoes of whoever leased.
No doubt about it.
And you've been paid your one half the royalty for it's got that lease 52 years since you've owned the, since you got into the picture.
Since we got into
the
picture.
One half the royalty.
Yes, sir.
And these lands are still being operated on that original lease, I think.
That's correct.
You're still getting your one half.
That's correct.
Okay, tell us why you should get more.
The reason we should get more is if you believe Green versus Robinson, Empire, and all those others, it clearly establishes that if the state of Texas gets $5, the surface owner gets $5. If the state of Texas gets $20, surface owner gets $20. I'm assuming here 100% ownership of the surface. The cases are all uniform that the state and the surface owner share equally in the consideration. And what we say is the settlement consideration here, the assignment, is in effect a payment made to the state to settle the lawsuit in a manner that extends the lease. And it does deprive us of the opportunity to put a lease out in the modern lease market. And at that time, Your Honor, that would have been a good market. And we were deprived of our right to exercise our rights as a leasing agent. And I think a principal owes some obligations to his agent not to interfere with the agency. Finally, I guess, Your Honor, I guess one of the things I'd have to say that it seems to me clearly indicates that a lot of this good agent, bad agent language is beside the point, is the state well knows that it had available to it a provision in the law that allows them to forfeit surface owner's agency right for failure to comply with the duties set out in the statute. They didn't do so. They haven't done so until today. So the fact of the matter is they had a statutory remedy for what they call a defaulting agent. They didn't use it. And the commissioner's letter, I think, at a minimum, recognized that whatever Exxon's rights were, they were the same at the time of this settlement as they had previously been, and that there had been no forfeiture. I'm about out of time. I want to give the court back some time, but simply to say to you, all we're saying is that it was right in the one instance of the DCRC settlement. It is right in this instance. The Court of Appeals correctly divined that to be true. They correctly read the cases that said that the state of Texas and the surface owner stand in parity in terms of the proceeds and benefits which flow from that lease. And Mr. Douglas makes a big deal out of, well, this is 58 years after the fact. The state of Texas today has taken the position, and in one of the cases cited in Senator Yarbrough's amicus brief on behalf of the Commissioner of the General Land Office, they took the position that an overriding royalty created 22 years after a lease was granted constituted consideration which the state was entitled to share in, citing Cross and citing the other authorities that are set out in our brief and the state brief. I appreciate the court's attention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you going to close, Mr. Brunell?
We're going to split up the time, but I'm going to be done quickly here, and I'll give the rest of the time to Mr. Douglas.
he shouldn't speak to the point, the last point he raised about the DCR settlement and this settlement.
I will, Your Honor. And, of course, if I leave something out, I'm sure Mr. Douglas will respond to it as well. But we've addressed that issue, Chief Justice Hill, in our briefs, and I'll address it again right now. I addressed it earlier in this argument. In that case, we're talking about the earlier Exxon lawsuit. The state was arguing that it never got a complete bonus. There was a loan that had been made to the surface owner by Exxon, which was not shared with the state. Now, the Relinquishment Act is clear, and it's correct, Mr. Ratliff is correct, that the Relinquishment Act is basically a creature of this court's interpretation. This court, back in 1928, saved the Relinquishment Act. It made it constitutional. But what it did also was it recognized that there had to be a cooperation between the surface owner and the state. And I'll get back to that in a second. But I would like to point out why this previous AG letter is not applicable. I pointed out earlier it's the bonus situation. That's different from this lawsuit. In addition, the parties were in effect negotiating a new lease, which was the legally expedient thing to do. They changed the terms. There was a $4 million bonus that was paid. There was an additional royalty. It was jacked up. There was acreage that was dropped. We had a new lease. Furthermore, this AG letter is not an AG opinion. And as you well know, of course, even if it were, this court does have the authority to construe the law the way it wants to. But it's not an AG opinion. And we're not embarrassed with this letter. It's a different case. It has no presidential value for this case here. Different facts, different issues, different settlement terms.
Counsel, it may be all that, but is it a different analysis as to the controlling case law?
No, it isn't, because as I pointed out, since there was this bonus issue and it was this $4 million that Attorney General Maddox had decided should be shared with the surface owner, since it was a bonus issue, since it was bonus that was being paid, that was bonus that was being paid pursuant to the execution of a new lease. Now, the Relinquishment Act specifically, as this court has interpreted, provides that the surface owner shall share with the state delay rentals, royalties, bonuses, and other consideration contracted for. That's something that Mr. Ratliff has consistently left out, contracted for. When the surface owner goes out and executes a lease, then he can share with the state the consideration that he receives pursuant to that executed contract. That's what was done in the Exxon lawsuit. It was a new lease. Now, he points out that in this case, that the state of Texas and Mobil and Mangus were re-leasing, I think is what he states. Well, that's simply not true. What was involved in this case was the state was going after 50-odd years of wrongful production. Now, Mr. Shannon Ratliff points out that it doesn't make any difference. The surface owner can't be required to do anything more than Exxon has already done. Under Colquitt, it couldn't have brought the lawsuit. It couldn't have maintained the lawsuit. It couldn't have had any bearing on what the state wanted to do in the lawsuit. Well, that totally misses the mark. The court has to look at public policy and has to look at constitutional restraints here as well. One of the reasons that the court back in this court back in Green v. Robeson held the statute to be constitutional is because it provided that the surface owner was receiving the proceeds because of damages and because of services. Now, Exxon has not been damaged any more as a result of the settlement than it was when it had the lease stayed in effect and there had never been a lawsuit. Furthermore, it hasn't provided any additional services. What Exxon wants to do is completely turn around 50 years of decisions by this court and say that the surface owner is no longer the agent. Once the state decides it's going to file a lawsuit or it should file a lawsuit, well, then the state has to start looking after the surface owner in his best interest and not the permanent school funds. Well, that's just wrong. That's simply wrong. The state's main purpose in filing lawsuits involving Relinquishment Act lands is to protect the permanent school fund. If there's any rights that the surface owner wants to protect, well, then he needs to get involved. But to say that now the state should be looking after the best interest of the surface interest owner is just simply wrong. Now, in addition to his arguing that there was a releasing, well, there is no releasing here. This was simply an assignment of a working interest. There was no additional bonus. There was no changed royalty. There was no releasing of surface. It was the same lease. It was just the assignment of the working interest. And finally, I would like to point out, in our briefs we do state this, and that is that Exxon didn't do anything at all. Basically, when the lawsuit was filed, it was taking the position that the lease was valid. Otherwise, it would have come in and assisted the state. But when it was ultimately determined that the state did have a good claim, it decided to change its mind. Well, it was too late. Whatever rights it may have had, it waived when it didn't get involved in that lawsuit and when it decided it wasn't going to help the state of Texas in prosecuting the lawsuit.
Thank you, Kevin.
May it please the court, I'd like to address three points that I think that Exxon has relied on. First of all, they have not cited to you any statutory authority, and they've even said that my client is very weak on statutory authority. Well, if that's the case, then the state wins, because that's the rule of strict construction. So if Exxon is going to try to rely on any statutory authority, it loses, no matter how weak Wally Scott trustee and the state are with reference to its county statutory authority. Secondly, I'd like to address the DCRC letter. There are recognized, I believe, in the cases, two bases for the surface owner to be compensated. One, by virtue of the statute, and two, by a rationale of services rendered. This is indicated in A.W. Walker Jr.'s learned article on this in the First Southwestern Legal Institute, and it also has been set forth in several cases, Empire Fuel, Lamar versus Garner, cases where it is indicated that services rendered. Now, what Mr. Ratliff and Exxon has proposed to this court today is a third basis for compensation to the surface owner. And that is, if the state did it in another case, they got to do it in this case. Well, I think what's been shown is, first of all, that other case is not the same case here. The lawsuit here did not seek to set aside this lease ab initio from the beginning. This lease sought to set it aside on the basis that it had not complied with the provisions of the lease. It said it was a valid lease in this lawsuit. In the DCRC case, that was the pleadings there was that it was not a valid lease from the very beginning. So that is, I think, a very significant distinction. And it's not a question of what Exxon has done wrong. It's a question of what that they didn't do anything as to come under the second rationale, so they have to shift to the third one. In fact, Mr. Ratliff described that third rationale before the Texas County Court of Appeals when we were arguing before it in San Antonio as being sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And I indicated to the court that in order to get the sauce for the gander, you couldn't be a turkey. And in this case, Exxon has been a turkey and not pursuing the situation that was here. Now, the third point I'd like to address is the equivalent of leasing. In the situation, you notice Exxon did not respond to my question. If the royalty and the surface have been divided after the original lease, in this mobile settlement, who does the state pay? How is that situation taken care of in the equivalent for leasing situation or their releasing situation? In other words, if the court rules in Exxon's favor here, the next case they're going to have is one where the royalty has been divided into one owner and the surface into the other. Who does the state pay in those circumstances? But more important than that, there is no statutory authority to compensate for the equivalent of leasing. They have the same problem in that argument if they're coming up. And thirdly, Exxon has not done any of the acts that are required in a situation for releasing or leasing. Those acts, for it to be the equivalent of leasing, is for somebody to go out and find a lessee that will develop the property and go out and make a lease with that lessee, try to get the best deal you can, and to get that lease executed. Those are the acts of leasing. Those are the acts of equivalent to leasing. And that's not what happened here.
Mr. Abbott said that you all didn't give him a chance. It was his client. You took control of the litigation, and everybody took control of the settlement. subsequent to a lease purchase?
Well, we certainly intervened in the case, as Mr. Ratliff did. We didn't have any more control over that lawsuit than he did once he's in as a party. And my experience has been with Exxon that they're certainly competent enough and have adequate lawyers to take care of their own interests in those lawsuits. So I don't think that we in any way control them in this situation. I believe Exxon knew exactly what it was doing. It was going to rely strictly on its status as a surface owner, that it was entitled to part of the proceeds. It didn't go after the lease. It didn't go after to set aside the lease. It didn't go after to try to get damages in that case involved. And one very clear reason it didn't, the advantage and the part of the compensation that Exxon received in that settlement, which again they don't answer here, is that if the state had been successful in setting aside this lease because of failure to develop and the 90-day development clause in this lease in 1932, and there was a motion for summary judgment filed in this case on that basis, based on records that were filed by Mobil with the Railroad Commission, they'd been successful, the state had been successful, then Exxon would have been required to repay all the royalties that it received or its predecessor entitled received for that 52-year or 53-year period that was involved there. And the reason for that is, as set forth in the cases, is Navarro versus Cross, cited to the court here, Supreme Court decision. The reason for that is that was unauthorized production and the state's entitled to recover. One other point, the cases that Exxon cites that it says it has authority to receive one half are cases where the state was recovering its one half when the surface owner was trying to retain more than one half. And I suggest to the court that that's not authority to give Exxon the right to recover in a settlement with reference to the state's minerals in an oil and gas lease that exists on minerally classified lands.
Describe for me before you leave the podium what the mechanics were of the settlement. Apparently there was some sort of ratification of the lease. Am I right about that?
I'll attempt to do it from the records I've read. And as you can understand, Water Scott trustee was not involved until January the 5th, 1984, when it received the settlement. But as I understand the mechanics, there was a settlement reached. There apparently was appeared to be a sale available for all the acreage that was involved here, both state and private. As a result of that, a settlement was reached, and it was agreed that that there would be a trial on January the 5th, or earlier than that, actually. There would be a trial where the lease would be determined to be valid, and when the lease was determined to be valid, it would be assigned to the two parties. That was the mechanics. And then supposedly the next step would have been a sale of that lease to a third party, for a substantial consideration. And that was, as I understand it, the general scheme of the settlement that had been set up. The only problem was that once Exxon intervened in the lawsuit, raised the question about the state's title, and whatever other events happened, the sale was never consummated. And Mr. Scott, I think, has served longer than he really anticipated with being trustee for the state. We'd urge that the Court of Appeals' decision be reversed and the trial court's decision be affirmed.
Thank
court
you.
Wants to thank all counsel. That finishes the business of the court. The marshal is leaving.